You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, David Cameron and his Golden Throne, John Lewis at Christmas, Juliet Harris on Lily Allen, Gogglebox Reviewed, and the Pretend iPod.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Parish Council. This is your podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw, and we might as well face it, he's addicted to love and puddings. He's Tarrant Stackham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw. Konnichiwa, mushy mushy. Yes, the puddings. Yes, I can't disagree with that. I love my food. Here's the thing, Magnus Shaw. No, really. Here's something. Last week we said that we would monitor the ongoing circus act. That is the Mayor of Toronto, Mr. Rob.
Oh, yeah.
And we said, well, we'll just keep an eye on it in case anything happens, there's developments. And he hasn't let us down. Mr. Ford, we mentioned last week, he has said quite openly that during his time as mayor, he's drunk very, very large amounts of alcohol, and indeed he's admitted smoking crack cocaine. this week, he had to face a vote in the Toronto council chamber, and 41 against 2 requested that Rob Ford step down, took a leave of absence. Yeah. But the trouble is that Toronto has no powers to sack its mayor, so Mr. Ford has vowed to stay. And yesterday morning, he became involved in yet another exchange, a bizarre exchange with reporters, in which he denied new allegations, but also made a remark about a former female staff member that, I feel rather like the News of the World used to say, I can't repeat here. Mm-hmm. Rob Ford, Magnus Shaw, the mayor of Toronto, he really is the gift that just keeps on giving.
Yeah, well, in all seriousness, it is a shame that the people of Toronto can't recall their mayor, because some kind of intervention is almost imperative now, because the poor chap is clearly in the grips of either a breakdown or at least some severe addictions or both. And, carrying on as he is, trying to cling on to office, or insisting that he stays in office, is just not going to help. He needs to set politics aside and find himself some treatment. And I really wish he would, because I don't see this ending well if we carry on like this. What is revealed is the gaping hole in Toronto's civil politics, is that you can't intervene and cut short the reign of a mayor, even when he goes so far off the radar that... he's entering other universes, because it's not fair on him, and it's not fair on his citizens, I don't think.
He, as I say, made these rather awkward and, as the BBC News described them, lewd remarks yesterday. And then, as he seems to have to keep doing these days, he had to give another press conference to apologise for the press conference that he had earlier in the day. And late last night, he gave this yet another statement. And his poor wife, Renata, standing there looking, I have to say, mortified. And he said, he said these things. I acted on complete impulse in my remarks, he said. His integrity as a father and husband had been attacked. But the thing was, when he made these remarks earlier in the morning, he was wearing a football jersey, a Toronto Argonauts football jersey, their Canadian Football League team. And it's got to the point now where the spokesman for the Toronto Argonauts felt obliged to put out a statement saying, these latest remarks while wearing our team's jersey are particularly disappointing. Yeah. So, he's being disenfranchised by everybody. But it does seem a most extraordinary thing where you can't impeach, I suppose would be the word, a mayor when it clearly... Yeah. appears not to be able to be, not in a fit state to undertake his duty.
Well, that's right. Yeah, in any other job, you you can be retrieved and set aside, can't you?
If you've
gone sort of psychologically AWOL. I'm starting to see him as the Charlie Sheen of Canadian politics, to be perfectly honest. I don't think there are real parallels with the Charlie Sheen breakdown. In that, the last person to realise how extreme it's all become is the poor sap who's who's undergoing this drug-induced freak-out. And that's a shame, you know, because he is humiliating himself and his family. And you'd like to think there is some mechanism, at least for his friends and relatives, to say, come on, Rob, let's set the career aside now and get you some treatment, because it's not good, you know. And I do fear for how it might end.
Yes, yeah, fair point. So let's hope that he does listen to more sensible voices, and hopefully next week we can report that he's
resting.
Seeking some resting, good word. Yes, I'm very familiar with that.
He could
term.
Do with a long rest, I think.
Yes, he could. Yeah. From one troubled leader to another closer to home, I'm going to offer you, Magnus Shaw, a few direct quotes from the Right Honourable David Cameron MP, Prime Minister.
Right.
I wondered what you were doing for a moment there. I thought, oh my God, he's died on live on the podcast. I see what you were doing there. Taken from his speech at the Lord Mayor's banquet earlier this week, this is what David Cameron had to say. We need to do more with less. Not just now, but permanently. It means building a leaner, more efficient state. We're capping welfare so that no family is better off on benefits than in work. And my position with it's not so much to do with the content of Mr. Cameron's speech, which, if I paraphrase it, essentially says austerity is here to stay. But it's largely the context in which he gave the speech. He stood to give this speech at the Lord Mayor's banquet, rising from a golden chair, a sort of throne, and stood before a golden lectern on which he placed his notes. And this during a dinner, indeed a banquet, as I say, of four courses, all served with fine wines, pork, brandy, whiskey. Now, with all of your branding and marketing expertise, Magnus Shaw, don't you think that someone from amongst his team of advisors might have said, hey, Dave, you know, this is going to look like the very living embodiment of one rule for the haves and another rule for the have-nots?
Yeah, hard for me not to sort of tackle the ideology involved, but I'll give it a shot.
Give it a go, but we'll forgive you if you stray into that area.
Okay. You know how they said in the First World War that the soldiers were lions led by donkeys?
Indeed.
You start to wonder whether politicians aren't donkeys led by complete and utter blithering idiots. also, it just seems astonishing to me that Cameron could not see the multi-layered irony ripped through what he was doing. How did this not occur to him, calling for financial restraint? You know, in his dicky bow, sipping a brandy, and as you say, rising from a golden throne. I feel sorry for Armando Iannucci, because it doesn't leave him very far to take his political satire writing, does it?
It's just as
Brass Eye in the day-to-day now look quite tame compared to the actual rolling news that we get. This is the same with the thick of it. I think reality has overtaken the thick of it. What he does need, Cameron, is a Malcolm Tucker, because this would never have happened on Tucker's watch, as we all know. And if it did, somebody would be dangling from a lamppost in Whitehall by now, wouldn't they? By parts of their anatomy that we needn't mention. But what I do think it indicates, and this is worrying for Cameron, but this also some delight for me, is this kind of thing starts to happen when a premiership is unravelling.
Right, okay.
You think of premierships that have gone terribly wrong. The Gordon Brown, for instance. Gordon Brown, I'm minded to think of Gordon Brown's YouTube message to the nation, where he was clearly briefed to smile, and until his jaw ached.
Random smiling video.
It was comical and excruciating and totally counterproductive. Mm. And this is sort of Cameron's smiling on YouTube moment. And I think these kind of things happen when there is too much else to worry about. The politicians blunder into these things because there really isn't the merest 30 seconds to pause and consider whether this has been planned and thought through correctly, because there is so much other flak landing simultaneously. And I think if a senior politician, indeed a prime minister, can make this sort of stark staring blunder, there must be unmitigated chaos behind the scenes. Otherwise, this would have been stage managed for a couple of days, and it clearly wasn't.
Yeah, very good point. Yeah, I agree with you, because, yes, a Malcolm Tucker figure would have pulled Cameron out of it, not out of the speech, but it would have said, my goodness, we've got to rewrite this, or at least have said, well, look, when you make your speech, let's lead you away from the golden throne and, you know, make your speech over here in front of a wooden lectern with a plain background.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Those simple things, and I think when you start crashing into walls like this and ricocheting off, it is indicative of, you know, there just being a snowstorm, a blizzard of crises behind the scenes, where everybody's eye is off that particular ball.
I think your newspaper, the Guardian, has actually said that it's the moment David Cameron lost the 2015 general election, which I think may be overdoing it a bit.
I was actually quite surprised at how little it was seized upon, to be honest. I think it could have been the moment that cost him the election. It could have been his Neil Kinnock at Sheffield moment, or Neil Kinnock on Brighton Beach. You know, I mean, this was a good example. He was a leader of the opposition, but he had a lot of traction for quite a long while, did Kinnock, especially with his routing of militant tendency and all that. Bought himself a lot of credibility, and then just as the election loomed, he dropped into a series of potholes which cost him the election. And this could have been the same for Cameron, except I was surprised the media bounced through it. I suppose the Philippines and stuff superseded it, and quite rightly so. But I did expect to see it splashed a bit more.
You're Steve Bell from Your Guardian. Well, yes. Did you see his cartoon? It was got a picture of David Cameron actually decapitating himself with a sword and saying permanent austerity, you know, it makes sense, and a sort of blood all over the
banqueting. We can live in hope, but he might have got away with this by the skin of his teeth, but it is a symptom of some greater crisis, I'm sure of it.
I think to put the lid on it in terms of the staging, if you like, this paean to austerity was delivered whilst Mr. Cameron was wearing the full formal evening dress, wasn't it, including a white tie, which always has that sort of element in difficult situations. It's kind of got that Bertie Wooster edge to it, doesn't it? Which, you know, when you're delivering a speech about how austerity is here to stay, you don't want to be seen as coming from, that sort of Drones, Mayfair, public school background.
An extra on Downton Abbey is how you come across, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And, you know, really, that sort of speech.
These Mansion House speeches are absolutely rife with pitfalls, though, aren't they, for prime ministers? I mean, just to go back to Gordon Brown for a minute, you remember mere months from global financial collapse, he went to the Mansion House and praised everyone in it as the great British heroes, and how their innovation and inventiveness had ushered in a new golden age of economic stability. And that was replayed over and over, wasn't it? Eventually happened. So I guess prime ministers have a duty, a requirement to attend these things. But boy, they are risky. They're risky business, and Cameron's proved that. Delivering his ode to poverty from a golden throne.
Golden throne, yes.
It's a Marie Antoinette moment, is for sure. Yeah.
It's certainly been described as that. I've got a memory of Gordon Brown rocking up to give that speech where he refused to wear the full white tie and everything. I think he turned up with his normal attire of a sort of lounge suit, white shirt and dark tie.
I think he wore a black tie, didn't he?
Black tie, right.
But certainly
the Cameron speech was one that should be made wearing an open neck shirt, and certainly not from a golden throne.
Definitely should have been made at a different time from from that point where he was being served port on a silver salver. If nothing else, it will serve as a training video for press officers and PRs going forward in politics. It really...
You would think, though, that in 2013, you know, they shouldn't need that sort of training. Mm-hmm. But in the latest Guardian ICM poll, the Conservatives are polling at 30%, Labour on 38%, Lib Dems on 13%, and UKIP on 10%. So that's the current state
of play. That's quite alarming for the Lib Dems to be almost neck and neck with UKIP. That's
UKIP, yes.
Really, really, dear me. We all said with some confidence, and I'm sure it will be, come to pass that the Lib Dems are finished at the next election, but to see the stark figures like that must give Nick Clegg some sleepless sweaty nights. I'd have thought, good grief.
So the news story about the context of the speech, that is the gold chairs, wine glasses, bronze horse statues, I didn't mention the bronze horse statues, has gone around the world and as Magnus mentioned there, with some news outlets actually describing it as David Cameron's Marie Antoinette moment. Yeah. Staying with marketing, though, there was I felt this was an extraordinary announcement in one of the commercial breaks during X Factor last weekend. This is what the voiceover said. Now a special treat, the premiere of an advert. And this ran into a commercial, obviously aimed at the Christmas market, for John Lewis stores. And considering they've only run these Christmas campaigns from a starting point as recently as 2007. How have they managed to secure this spot in which they give the impression that the Christmas season officially starts only when their usually tear-jerky advert is aired?
We'll go and have a guess how they managed to secure that.
By a massive input, £7 million into the video, I believe, and making it tear-jerky so that people say, oh, look at that little bear and that hare.
Well, yeah, that's the creative angle. I mean, they secured that slot and the unprecedented announcement with fistfuls of cash.
That's $7 million it cost just to make the video. $7 million.
It did, yeah. That's before.
I have to say, I'm not a socialist, but that kind of sticks in my craw. That, you know, when Waitrose, I think, in the last 2 years have said, look, we're not making fancy adverts, and we're, I think, going to donate to, you know, one of our, you know, those little green token charities.
Yeah, yeah, or whatever. Yeah.
It does rather stick in my throat, this £7 million on an advert. It's their money.
But Terence, you know, that is your free market.
Absolutely.
It's John Lewis's money. They can spend it on brass... horse statuettes.
Horse statues or a gold throne.
Yes,
for
a
the
gold
chairman.
Throne or a television commercial. That's surely that's the free market, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
just doesn't seem quite doesn't quite add up for me. But anyway, yes. So you were saying that sackfuls of
cold
cash.
Hard cash. I am curious as to how ITV and John Lewis have conspired to get round the Advertising Standards Authority. Because broadcasters in this country, commercial broadcasters, are supposed to be at pains to distance commercials from the programme itself, unless it's product placement, which is now allowed. And so to announce commercials is a grey area. I think my learned friends must have picked up a fee here to double, triple check that ITV could do this. Of course, they've never done it before and possibly won't do it again in a hurry. But I think it sails very close to the regulator's wind. And was a little daft, wasn't it, to have an advert announced. But, it did draw everybody's attention to it. I'm really a little bit puzzled as to where the $7 million has gone. The advert's delightful and beautifully made and elicits the intended ahs from everybody. So my daughter and my wife both went, oh, bear and hare. So it really it works on that level. But is that £7 million there on the screen? And I'm quite surprised.
Yeah, well, yes, I agree with you. There's an element in the actual content of the cartoon that disturbs me a little bit, because the story in this cartoon, as in the other, the hare wakes up a hibernating, or the hibernating bear, by using an alarm clock, but that's in the middle of his winter hibernation period. Won't he be feeling really peed off? You know, he, instead of dancing down to the Christmas tree and joining in, you know, with all the celebrations, I would have thought he'd be thinking, you know, God, I go into my cave for my winter hibernation, and you know, this hare comes along and puts a bloody alarm clock ringing in the I think he'd be well peed off.
Yes, I think he might be in danger of taking the whole concept a little bit too seriously, but.
I suppose I was thinking it was real there for a moment. Yes. You know, this is always the trouble with me. I always think things are real.
And you, you raised the question as to whether this is going to introduce sales, if this is going to increase sales at John Lewis. So, I don't think that's the intention, or certainly this isn't tactical advertising. I don't want to get into a treatise on advertising, but tactical advertising are those ads that say, get down to Sofa Warehouse, there's 50% on all off all sofas tomorrow only. That's a tactical advert. It's in that it offers you something that can be obtained immediately by leaving the house and joining in. The John Lewis ad isn't a tactical ad, it's a strategic ad, in that it is designed to give you a certain impression, a certain feeling, a certain emotional engagement with the John Lewis brand. So, and that probably does that very well. Of course, the intention of both tactical and strategic advertising is ultimately to bring about increased sales. But with strategic advertising, especially this John Lewis one, it's intended to do it in a slightly more, well, some would say insidious, but slightly more subtle way.
I was just thinking, you know, you said about my learned friends and checking about the ties of adverts to programs. I'm fairly sure that was relaxed some time ago because, and here's my prime example of why it must have been, in the middle of X Factor, you see adverts which you would never have seen 10 years ago of Nicole Scherzinger licking the lid of a yogurt
pot. That's perfect. That is okay. Yes, I know that was restricted previously, and that has been relaxed. Of course, there's been huge lobbying from commercial broadcasters to have all this stuff relaxed, and a lot has been as a result, but. Actually, for the continuity of the announcer to say, watch this ad, still think that's quite close to where the regulator draws the line, but clearly ITV felt comfortable with it.
I suppose they must have done. Yeah, there's along with this campaign, there's even an interactive e-book I discovered, narrated by Lauren Laverne, which gives the story of the bear and the hare in an even more separate kind of context.
Oh, well, everybody's filling their boots with this then, aren't they?
Lily
Allen doing the song, Lauren Laverne doing the storybook, then you've got your 7 million on the animation, and it's a bean feast for all.
It really is, yes. And of course, as you say,
this coming weekend, recording this on a Friday, we have all that will be washed away. All the John Lewis stuff will be washed away. That was so last weekend, because this weekend we have the 4.5 minute Sainsbury's ad.
Oh Lord, really? Oh good grief!
A whole longer than a whole break it will take to watch it.
Oh. Christmas will really feel here with Sainsbury's trying to.
This is not permanent austerity on the high street. This isn't
clearly not. No. As you just mentioned there, the song soundtracking the John Lewis commercial is Keane's Somewhere Only We Know, sung rather delightfully, I have to confess, by Lily Allen, who has her own single out on 17th of November, so there could be she could be battling with herself up the charts, because apart from the John Lewis track, her first single since 2010, Hard Out Here, it's been released, it's been described, as I say, 17th of November, been described by Rolling Stone magazine as a feminist anthem through and through. Well, rather than hear two middle-aged men bumble on confusingly about feminism, we knew just who we should turn to, and earlier today I asked our Juliet Harris if she feels Lily Allen is making a statement of social critique or just having a bit of a laugh.
Well, that is a very good question, and I'm glad you asked me that, to use that erstwhile phrase. Firstly, really nice to have Lily Allen back. For my money, if we're talking about the last decade, 2000-2010, probably in the top three lyricists, I think, of her generation. I love the fact that she's come back with what I think is doing a bit of both, actually. I think she is having a laugh, because Lily Allen is someone that I think is incredibly witty. I think her lyrics are just, I love how colourful they are and how witty they are. But also, I think she is making quite a serious point. I mean, the bit at the beginning with her on the operating table in the video dialed out here, and the various men sort of complaining about how she'd let herself go, and she was explaining she'd had two children, and also the lyrics were really rather pointed, I think, throughout. So I actually think she is making quite a serious point. However, the way in which she's gone about doing that in the video doesn't always best support her aims, I don't think. I think the fact that it's had the video, I think I heard someone say on the radio yesterday, has had 2 million hits in 2 days.
Wow.
So I mean, it's probably going to be a number one, isn't it? Particularly off the back of the advert with the cartoon animals in it. So the idea that there is someone who is, you know, articulate talking about these issues in a record is really great, I think. But the these bumping and grinding women in the video, I think what she's trying to do is she is trying to parody those hip-hop, yes, blingy videos of yore. There's been a few pieces online, particularly I think Ellie Mae O'Hagan wrote in The Guardian that she had problems around race with that video, the fact that quite a lot of the backing dancers are of colour.
They're all of
no
one
there was
colour.
there's a pink haired girl in it. There's at least white girl in it, I think. They're not all of colour, but the vast majority are, I think. Whether or not, maybe she was just doing that because that is perhaps representative of a lot of those hip-hop blingy videos with rappers, I don't know. Obviously, by trying to parody it, it looked rather dangerously close to the real thing, actually, and I'm not sure. Obviously, she's done it to get attention, and it does do that. It's very provocative, but I don't think it's intentionally racist at all. But I think that if you are complaining about misogyny and prejudice, it's a very thin line that you're walking, and I'm not sure. I didn't need to see all that, to be honest. I really like the record, and I probably would have enjoyed it more had I not seen the video that went with it, I think.
And trying to make a statement, as you say, and possibly by trying to make that parody, it's not entirely clear all the way through, as you allude to, that it is a parody. She did say today that, you know, well, did everybody expect her to audition people and rule them out and say, well, we've got too many black people or African-Caribbean people, we better bring some white in. She said, white people, and she said that she got picked.
I mean, that is probably the reality of it. And I, like I say, I don't think there was any malintent behind that at all. I really can't believe that of Lily Allen for one moment. And I do think that I do think, thank God, that we've got, you know, someone that is, in a way, sort of willing to put it on the line a bit, because, you know, I think pop stars have to be increasingly bland nowadays anyway. And of course, the point she's making in the song is that, you know, if she was a bloke, she, you know, no one would bat an eyelid at her singing about, you know, how many people she'd slept with or all that kind of stuff. Yet the fact that she's a woman means that she's having to play by different rules. And I still think that is prevalent in pop. I think it's better than it was, but I certainly don't think it's gone away. And whilst Lily Allen is obviously an established pop artiste, equally, it is a risk, I think, to do that kind of stuff and to be as outspoken as she is. And certainly the lyrics make a much better fist, I think, of being, you know, of shining a light on it. And I think it's a good reply to Blurred Lines, which I think is the kind of thing it's sort of getting at. But it's partly getting at blurred lines, and it's partly getting, certainly the video suggests it's partly getting at sort of rap hip hop culture, or that strand of rap hip hop culture generally. I'm in favour of the fact she's done it. I'm in favour of the fact she's back and that she takes risks. I don't think many artists in her position necessarily would. I mean, I'd be surprised if Jessie J did that. I think the fact that she is articulate, the fact that she is willing to take the risk is laudable. I'm not entirely sure about the video, but I like the song. The whole thing is meant to be parody, I think, in that actually it sounds like quite a lot of music of its ilk, and it's rather, I suppose it is a statement that it's rather musically out of character for her a bit. I mean, her first album was all very kind of quite sort of sweetly calypso, wasn't it? And then the second album was obviously a bit more of a sort of a glossy upmarket kind of thing. But this is in a way musically the most commercially sort of thing she'd done, and it would be interesting to see if she's just done that to suit this song because it's meant to be this kind of parody of that sort of music, or whether this is her music now. I really hope it's the former rather than the latter, because I kind of miss sort of skiffly, weirdy Lily Allen from that first album. I must have listened to it about a billion times. So I am pro Lily, not necessarily pro Lily's video in entirety, but I'm certainly, I think it's a good song, and I think actually the lyrics are less ham-fisted and better at making the point sort of slightly lighter than the video is.
I suppose I should tell you what this bitch is thinking. You'll find me in the studio and not in the kitchen.
That is definite, isn't it? It's not a pure rhyme, but I quite like that in a way. And how, you know, she talks about how, you know, you're 6 stone and you're not 6 stone and you're not good looking. So here's hoping you're something or good at cooking. I mean, I think it's, you know, I enjoy the fact that someone has just got up and gone, do you know what? No. And I think it's obviously 4 minutes, 21 seconds worth of that, but and it's slightly more tuneful, but in an increasingly sort of bloodless pop world, it's very nice that where something like Blurred Lines, I mean, because Blurred Lines was just, let's not forget, was just released as a pop song, and I think the most worrying thing was that wasn't trying to make a statement, they just thought that was okay. Which is the most frightening thing of all, I think, whereas this is obviously trying to make a statement. So although I've had my criticisms of the video, in a way, I can forgive them a bit more because I think the intent behind it is good, whereas Blurred Lines is just one of the most vile lyrics ever, I think, frankly. Weirdly, I heard the song on the radio, and you know when you're driving in the car, you're not really listening, and I thought, oh, I love the backing track of this. I really like this. I'm going to download it. So I bought it. And then I listened to it, and then once I started paying attention to the words, it was sort of revelatory, really. It's just startlingly unpleasant, I think.
Horrifying, in my view. So I suppose to summarise, although equality won't be achieved through a pop song, we're kind of applauding Lily Allen for at least making a few people think, and maybe just a few little more steps up that ladder.
I think so, yes. And I think a lot of 14-year-old girls hearing the messages in this record is no bad thing at all. And whilst we're on equality, the one point I wanted to make, which is what you said at the beginning, was that, I'm not sure sort of two middle-aged men talking about friends. I mean, on the one side, yes, I agree with that, in that, you know, when you think of Newsnight and all-male panels talking about childcare and stuff, you know, yes, you need balance. But equally, I'd like to make the point that equality is everybody's business. So it shouldn't just be, you know, just the same, you know, just the same as, you know, white people can talk about racism as well. I think whilst obviously it's nice to be here, hello, equally, you know, I think the idea that sort of men aren't allowed to, I wouldn't like to live in a world where certain people are excluded from talking about equality issues. Equality is everybody's business, even Lily Allen's, I think, is the message of that.
And the other way around as well. I thought, I don't want everybody to start thinking, oh, there's an issue on feminism. I bet they get that Juliet Harrison because your field is much wider.
Well, that's, you know, there's not a lot I won't burble on about, frankly, if anybody asks me to. And as always, it is a pleasure to join the RV Massive in doing that burbling.
Oh, well, thanks very much for joining us this week.
Thank you for parachuting me in.
I suppose I should tell you what this bitch is doing.
There's a clip there of Lily Allen's Hard Out Here. I've mentioned on previous podcasts my concern about the likes of Robin Thicke and Miley promoting sad and unhelpful images to young girls. At least Lily Allen is striking a small blow for women whose ambition in life stretches further than twerking.
She is, and it makes her all the more interesting for it. I'm not sure she always does it without a little clunkiness. The video, the Hard Out Here, I think could have been better executed. I mean, I do like the spoofs on those Robin Thicke-style videos that are in there. The whole stuff about her having liposuction at the beginning and the record company manager pointing at bits of her to be sucked out, I just thought it was a bit clunky. I think that could have been done a bit more intelligently. But I'm splitting hairs because on the whole, on the whole, it's great to have a Lily Allen who's there to upset the apple cart and to at least have a stab at counterbalancing this sort of endless stream of, well, has to be said, hip-hop and R&B videos, which, apart from being terribly sexist and giving bad impressions to girls and young men about relationships between the sexes, they're just terribly tiresome and unimaginative, aren't they? And
yes, they are.
And I'm glad Lily Allen and anybody like her is having a stab at pointing that out and doing something that's artistically at the end of the scale. And thank goodness in that kind of climate for Lady Gaga as well, who at least is giving the impression that it's perfectly all right to be, you know, anything other than stereotypically sexy. So this is all good stuff. My main concern about this, and perhaps somebody can set me right on this, I might have got completely wrong end of the stick, is that alongside this, Lily Allen has done a topless photo shoot.
Oh, no, you're joking.
No, I'm almost certain that I'm right in saying that.
I didn't know that. Oh, my goodness.
And I don't know whether one can do a topless photo shoot, ironically. And I can only guess that was the intention. But can you? Does that work? And does that not risk defusing her whole campaign?
Well, as by my reaction, you can tell I didn't know anything about it. And if it is correct, and it's difficult, I suppose, without knowing the context, but that would trouble me immensely.
Yes, I don't have a welter of context to put it in. It's an absolute fact that there is a topless Lily Allen photo shoot.
Oh, dear. I won't go on about this at length because I have done so in the past, but it is something that troubles me an awful lot, that there is a generation of young people across the world who are learning, boys and girls, learning to have relationships with each other, not by understanding that if you have strong feelings for somebody and you can show them love and they'll give you love back, and that's probably the best thing in the world, is, you know, to love and be loved. They don't learn that. They learn that relationships are based on what they see in both pornography on the internet and by the behaviour of some certain sort of R&B groups, men and women, that leave women in really the vulnerable position in a relationship, and appearing that they've got to behave in a certain way to satisfy the boy or man. And that, I just don't like that at all. No. That's not the way to have a satisfying and happy life, in my view.
And I absolutely agree. And one would hope the executives coining in huge amounts of money from producing these videos and songs will, one day have cause to reflect on what they've done. As I said before, I don't think you can legislate, and I don't think you can censor pop music, and pop music has always been sexualized and often irresponsibly so. I do think we're sort of stuck in an unfortunate place with the portrayal of women in certain areas of pop music at the moment. I agree.
We are. One thing just before we move on that troubled me recently was we were just talking about X Factor a few minutes ago. That when Dermot O'Leary, I felt a bit uncomfortable, had X Factor had Robin Thicke on, only about 2 or 3 weeks ago, doing a sort of perspiring performance of one of his songs that fit into the categories that I've just been describing. That seemed a kind of anachronism. It didn't feel quite right that we've got this family show, and there's Dermot O'Leary, you know, nice, pleasant fellow, saying, oh, you know, we love Blur Lines. You know, it's great to have you here, Robin. And, you know, there's his performance where, again, women are treated as secondary characters to appease and to please the chap in whichever way he demands. It just didn't feel right that Dermot was standing there saying, oh, you know, love Blur Lines. You know, it just felt wrong.
Perhaps you're doing Dermot O'Leary a little bit too much of a credit there, because I think he's doing very nicely in a very cynical business. Mm. And I have nothing against Dermot O'Leary, but he certainly appeared on the media assuring us that there would be no cruelty in the audition rounds of this year's X Factor, and it was as cruel as it ever was. So
worse than ever, I would say.
I would suggest that, without being too pejorative, that Dermot O'Leary knows which side his bread's buttered on. So I wouldn't paint him as any more of a saint than Cowell or anybody else filling their boots in the music industry.
From ITV to Channel 4, because when it was announced that Channel 4 had commissioned a new show in which we watch other people watching television, it led to many commentators making wry observations along the lines of, what next, 10 hours of watching paint dry? But Gogglebox has been the big TV hit of 2013. The producers insist that much of the success is based on them featuring people who didn't apply or audition. They actively search for people who looked interesting, to quote what they say. You spent an hour this week watching people watching TV, Magnus Shaw. Are you now a convert to the cult of Gogglebox?
Yes, 100%. I've spent more than an hour. I've spent 3 hours watching people watching television, because I went back and watched the ones that I hadn't seen before after watching this week. We've spoken before about situation comedy and classic situation comedy, and I've posited that, the writing is pretty crucial, but really when you boil down a successful sitcom, it's the casting that is the cherry on the cake. And this is the forte of Gogglebox, because on paper, and this is why I haven't watched it, I couldn't imagine how this was going to be entertaining. Watching people watching television can't possibly be entertaining, thought I. Well, it is, and it is all down to the people they've selected to watching television. Absolutely wonderful. I mean, comic actors take note. you might even consider that you're in a hiding to nothing, reading and learning and performing scripts that somebody has delivered for you. When these people are out there, they are absolutely marvellous. I want to watch telly in their houses at least once a week. Just join in. You can't underestimate the appeal of the great British eccentrics, and there are more out there than we ever realised, is that these people are just tremendous. The one-liners that they come out with spontaneously and certainly oblivious to what they're saying are just delicious. There was a fantastic moment in Gogglebox this week. They were watching Question Time.
Mm.
And for those who haven't seen it, one of the families, in inverted commas, watching TV as we watch them, a middle-aged chap who sits in a recliner. Next to him is an occasional table. I don't know what it is the rest of the time. And next to him, his wife, retired. I'm guessing they're retired.
They are retired. Retired teachers.
Yeah, retired teachers, exactly.
June and Leon.
So they're watching Question Time, and we see a clip of Anna Soubry, who lives very, very close to me, Anna Soubry does, giving a very pointed statement. And it cuts back to the gentleman viewer there, and he says, "Well, that's the most sense I've ever heard from a Tory MP. She really knows her stuff. I'm very impressed with that, with her. Do you know what? I think I will write her. I'll write her a letter and tell her how wonderful she did on this programme." Perfectly timed pause. "What's her name?"
Yes.
Great. And yes. And one of the other episodes I was watching, there's now I don't know their relationship. Are they sisters? The Afro-Caribbean couple, the two.
I
two
think
two,
they're friends. Are
they just friends, are they? Okay, brilliant.
I think so.
And they are. I mean, they're just fantastic. And whilst they're watching, this wasn't in this week's episode. It was a previous one. Whilst they're watching, there's a mouse in their flat.
I didn't know about that.
Well,
okay. Oh no.
I'm
this is Sandy and Sandra from Brixton.
Watching them trying to watch television whilst watching a mouse running around their flats was one of the great comic moments of the year.
Sandy and Sarge from Brixton, they always have rather extreme views on what they're watching, and I suspect that's influenced by the stickers praising Jesus that are stuck to their TV. No regret in Jesus, says the sticker. I don't quite understand that. No regret in Jesus.
I want to go around their place to watch telly because it looks like a bundle of fun. But the Gogglebox is a great show, and it's all down to the participants.
Just with Sandy and Sandra for a moment, you mentioned about the mouse. I've noticed that there always seems to be an empty pot noodle carton next to the larger lady. I think she uses that as a cup.
A cup, maybe.
Or else she's
yeah.
mainlining pot noodles, but I think she's using it as a kind of beaker.
Oh, right. I thought maybe an ashtray.
Oh, possibly. Yeah. Possibly. We'll have to look at other episodes and report back on that. Once again, I appear to be the greatest snob in the United Kingdom.
Who'd have thought?
I accept this. I accept the award on behalf of myself. Because the lack of depth of some of the featured viewers bewilders me. The lack of depth of sort of knowledge. Many seem to lack any sort of knowledge of basic current affairs. What about E.T.? He come down.
that's a brilliant line.
He come down. This was Linda trying to confirm that UFOs exist. What about E.T.? He come down. She also said... later, she also said... Well, when watching Question Time with Nigel Farage, immigrants cleaned my car marvellous. These are the justification for the immigration policy of the current government. Her husband, George, he promptly fell asleep at the prospect of more from Sean Ryder on UFOs. And their son was quite proud that he'd got thrown out of a nightclub three times that was featured in some programme. But do you like the couple who appear to like a drink or two? They're called Steph and Dom Parker. They always giggle. They talk utter tosh whilst giggling and laughing uproariously. Yeah. I had a bit of a...
any moment expected to be a tap at the door and Dominic to say, "That'll be Terence."
Yes, come on in. Well, they live in a Grade 1 listed home in Kent. Now, I didn't realise this. If you had asked me, and I'm going to ask you, what they do with their lives, I would have said he's a stockbroker and she, you know, rides a horse at her, you know, in the stables, and that's their life.
Yeah.
Would you have said
something
similar?
Like that. Yes, yes.
They run a bed and breakfast.
Oh, do they?
I can't believe that. Yeah. They're in the most unlikely pair to run. Can you imagine Steph and indeed Dom serving up, you know, the full English breakfast on a Monday morning?
Yeah, well, it would be entertaining to say the least. Yes, yeah. But they're great as well, and I think that's important actually that they run a bed and breakfast because what. Gogglebox does, and it's, I don't want to give it too much the social depth because it's not really about that at all. But what if it does have any depth? It's the fact that we shouldn't dismiss any type of person as being not our sort of folk, you know, or distancer, because you know everybody is idiosyncratic and can surprise you. Everybody can surprise you, and you shouldn't take people at face value. And I would gladly spend an evening with any of the people on Gogglebox because they all look tremendous fun. You know?
Well, by the way, June and Leon, the retired teachers that you were talking about with the reclining chair,
yes.
they joined Twitter a couple of days ago and indeed are interacting wonderfully with people that are saying, you know, how much they're enjoying it. And indeed, they appear to be the couple that are being recognised most throughout the land. They talk of, you know, people coming up to them in Birmingham and Cardiff and saying, you know, oh, you're from Gogglebox.
Yeah.
But yes, Gogglebox is proving very popular, and I have seen many positive tweets and newspaper reviews. It almost doesn't matter what they're watching. It's more about regular viewing of Gogglebox, as I think you alluded to there, that you went back and looked at earlier episodes. It means we get to know the characters.
Right.
And they are, it does come across as like many of them are members of a sort of extended royal family, and I mean R-O-Y-L-E, yes. Royal family. Something realised by the producers of Gogglebox, who invited Craig Cash to be the narrator.
Yeah, I could have done without Craig Cash's narration, yeah. Actually. I assume this is his real voice, because it's the same voice he deploys in the royal family, and it does grate a bit, I have to say, elongated vowels. And I don't know if it needed narration at all, to be honest. You could have put a caption up that says Question Time, and then we get them watching Question Time. I don't know if we
True.
Needed that sort of watch this is funny sort of signposting,
no,
you know.
I agree. We talked about this last week in that it had the voiceover, the sort of smart alecky voiceover element of Come Dine With Me, which it didn't fit into the context of this show. It wasn't needed, and I think, yes, a caption saying Question Time or the news or you know, whatever they were,
yeah.
Watching the Sean Ryder and his UFOs. This was Gogglebox. It's on Wednesdays at 10 o'clock on Channel 4. Executive producer is Tanya Alexander for Studio Lambert. Now, if you're planning to go and see the new hit movie, the 3D space drama, Gravity, don't worry, I absolutely promise I'm not going to give away the plot or throw you any spoilers. Earlier this week, I had lunch with three friends. Didn't have a pudding, actually. I know. We were walking back to the car park in Henley on Thames when one member of our party said, oh, look, Gravity is on at the cinema. Let's all go and see it together. So, suddenly we found ourselves in a small room with a big screen and seven other people in attendance in the cinema in Henley. Now, I enjoyed the film, and we all know, let's be honest, I'm a bit dense. We know this. But for a straightforward drama like this, Gravity, I surely shouldn't have needed to have gone through a sort of debriefing session in the pub afterwards. I kept asking, I guess saying like, oh, okay, I understand that, but how did she get from there to there?
This is like watching a film with my daughter.
Oh, is
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
I was doing the same thing. I said, you know, well, how did George Clooney appear there, and why? And I don't know if I fell asleep and missed some vital piece of plot. I don't think I did. Maybe I'm just simply dopey. However, all of this led me to pick this week's choice for the Pretend iPod. The Pretend iPod, it's a sort of rockadoodle-doo playlist that we add to each week. You can find it on the Rocking Vicar website and on Spotify under the name of my colleague here. Look, there he is over there. Look, Magnus Shaw. Imagine, if you will, that you release a series of singles, and this is what happened to them chart-wise in the UK. First single, 1992, number one. Next single reaches number 16. Next, number 26. Next, number 30. Next one, number 40. Next one, number 45. And then the next and last three singles you release, no chart position at all. So starting at number one and then just working downwards ever after. Such is the career to date of Tasmin Archer, who sailed or perhaps orbited to number one with Sleeping Satellite in the autumn of 1992. Showing how much record companies know, the acoustic version of that song was on the demo tape that got turned down by every major UK label in the late 1980s. So, we may ask ourselves, what has Tasmin Archer been doing since her success in the early 1990s? Well, she hit a lengthy period of writer's block and couldn't seem to overcome it, so she did the sensible thing. She turned to football. Her partner, John Hughes, took her to see Sunderland play, and she was completely hooked, and she's been a season ticket holder, most unlikely if you sort of followed the career of Tasmin, season ticket holder at Sunderland since 1999. She says, it felt just like nothing I'd ever experienced. It felt so good being with fellow Sunderland supporters, like being part of a family or tribe. Sleeping Satellite, 1992, a wonderful evocative song about looking to the skies and considering man's greatest adventure against the neglect that we show to our own planet. Released 31st of August 1992, number 32 on the Billboard Hot 100, number 1 on the UK Top 40, 4 minutes 15 seconds, Tasmin Archer, Sleeping Satellite.
Yeah, it's a great record, and it's really unfortunate that she didn't have that follow through, because it was a really interesting record to find a song at number 1 that isn't about boy meets girl and falls in love. Is always refreshing, and I remember reading interviews with Tasmin Archer around the time of this surprise smash hit that she had, and I think what she was particularly dismayed about was that we'd stopped our space exploration that she was very condemnatory of NASA and people for not going further. There's a sort of stopping as far as the moon. Now, of course, it's got worse now. We don't really go anywhere now, do we? We leave that to the Indians and the Chinese. But there's an interesting subject matter, saying, we got to the moon and our adventure had begun, and then nothing. Not the kind of thing everybody writes a song about, so it was interesting from that point of view. It's a really good song as well, to boot, it's very memorable. I haven't heard it for a long, long time, but I can sing the whole thing in my head.
I played it a few times yesterday, and it just sounded great. It just sounded so wonderful, because, like you, I hadn't heard it for a while. Went to see this movie, Gravity, and it just came into my mind as I was watching it and as the titles went up. And then when I got home, I played it, and it just sounded so bright and fresh. That I thought, that's my pick for this week.
Well, interesting. I suppose there's a parallel between the subject matter of Sleeping Satellite and Tasmin's career, because I do remember seeing a magazine at the time with a per picture on the front, and it said, The Irresistible Rise of Tasmin Archer.
Right.
Which is true. She did rise from nowhere to the top of the charts, but then nothing. And that's really what the song's about, isn't it? It's about rising very quickly to the pinnacle of an adventure and then going no further. So
little did she know. And I should say as well, by the way, that she's become sort of completely hooked on football. It didn't cure her writer's block, but it's kind of given her something else. It's absolutely genuine. I got a photo that I was going to send you. I don't know if I put it on the website or whatever, but with her wearing her Sunderland scarf. And, there was, as she puts it, no eureka moment. Right. She just got into football instead.
Well, she's still got Sleeping Satellite. I mean, I always think of people who have a number one and then very little thereafter. That's always unfortunate and not the intention. But, you can live the rest of your life knowing that you had a number one hit single. And, I can't do that, and very few people
can.
I envy people that, even if they didn't get a career off the back of it.
She's a lovely lady. She's my Facebook friend, and she's still interacts to her fans.
Great.
And she's this very splendid woman. Just lovely.
Good stuff. Well, unfortunately, amongst all the earnestness and attitude, it was easy to miss the rather enjoyable absurdity which came with New Wave in the late 70s. Yeah, happily, punk's more camp and flamboyant inclinations, though, were largely encapsulated in just one band, and they were the third leg of the Clash Pistols tripod. They were the Damned. And one of the first bands I ever saw live, the very first band I ever saw live, were the Angelic Upstarts, and then the Damned, if I remember rightly.
And that's not bad. That's not a bad
it's
start.
It's not a bad start. No, no. And both gigs were in this derelict cellar, which I've mentioned before, which masqueraded as a rock venue, Nottingham's Sandpiper Club. If you lived in Nottingham in the 70s, you may have known the Sandpiper. Just the kind of place that doesn't exist anymore, because really, it really was a hole in the ground with a stage in it. But right. You know, what better place to see punk bands, I guess. And the Damned always seemed an awful lot of fun. Like the Sex Pistols, of course, could be out there dismembering popular culture and the Clash storming the barricades. But if you wanted a right old pogoing knees up, then the Damned were certainly your men. Almost accidentally, they invented goth rock about 10 years too early, and you only had to look at Captain Sensible and his womble jumpers and red berets and Dave Vanian all painted up like a 100 Club Bela Lugosi to know these fellows were never going to be dull. And they never were. Now, they weren't always alight with inspired brilliance, but actually, at their best, they did produce some of the most exciting singles to lurch out of that punk period. Who could forget New Rose, acknowledged to be the first real UK punk record. Love Song, a bit later on. I Just Can't Be Happy Today, which I still adore. And the sorely underrated Smash It Up. There was something fantastically and theatrically entertaining about the Damned. Indeed, the more absurd they were, the better they sounded. So, how about an opus 17-minute horror B-movie of a track? Curtain Call took up the whole side of the band's 1980 double LP, The Black Album, and it is by turns creepy, hilarious, and fabulously catchy. It breaks all the punk rock rules. This is punk prog. It is concept punk, and it is quite brilliant. The last time I listened to Curtain Call was during one of those summer lightning storms we had earlier this year. What better accompaniment to all that driving rain and electric night sky? It was perfect. All I needed was the Damned to be playing it live in the garden, and everything would have been complete. If you give Curtain Call a whirl, and I urge you to do so, find 17 minutes out of your weekend and stream this from somewhere, but you can't quite get your head around it, you just might be taking the track a little bit too seriously, and that is something the Damned would never do. It's my pick for the Pretend iPod this week. It's the Damned and 17 minutes, a whole side of an LP. Curtain Call.
It's a bit Doors-ish, isn't it?
Yeah.
In a way. I don't know if that was a deliberate aspect they were aiming for.
I think they had a passing acquaintance with, Riders on the Storm, Rayman.
It's got that feel to it. Do you like all the swirly, new agey bit in the middle as well?
I love it all. When we get into that, so the panning footsteps down the alleyway and the driving rain and everything, I just know that they are not doing it in earnest. They are having a ball. How much more daft can we make this record? Well, I say, well, what about if at this bit we just go and get all the sound effects that we can find and sort of meld them together? So I don't know, the humour comes through even in that swirly bit, as you call it.
Still going strong today, of course, with two of the original members, Captain Sensible and Dave Vanian, in the band. And Rhett Scabies now playing with my mates in the Members.
Yes, he is. Yes, that's right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm off to see the Damned on the 4th of December, I think.
Oh, yes, you mentioned with somebody else.
They are playing at the top of my road with the Ruts, or the remaining members of the Ruts. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and literally at the top of my road, which I just feel duty-bound to my 15-year-old self, really, that if at the age of 15 I'd have found the Damned were playing at the top of my road, I would have probably passed out with excitement. So I really should honour that, shouldn't I, and go. So that's what I'm going to do.
Oh, I think you do. If it's at the end of your road, I mean, you're obliged to attend.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
That's The Damned with Curtain Call and Tasmin Archer, Sleeping Satellite, joining the extensive playlist of the Pretend iPod Magnus.
The Damned finally making it onto the list, and indeed Tasmin Archer finally making it onto the list, and bringing our podcast shenanigans to a close for another week, I'm afraid. There are cakes to be baked, there are hamsters to be fed, and we must take our leave. So thank you, Terence.
Thank you, see you soon.
And thank you to you, our friend the listener. We'll come back in 7 days, do it again. Bye bye.
I blame you for the moonlit sky and the dream that died with the eagle.
Media production.
Hello. No. Tesco.
It's not.
Morrison's.
Not. It's too expensive.
No, you put him a Christmas present.
Christmas present.
It is a Christmas advert.
Oh, bless him. Iceland?
No, it's not Iceland. It's a posh shop.
Oh, this is the John Lewis advert, isn't it?
So little fella's been all the way to John Lewis.
He must be exhausted.
Yeah.
This animation is incredible, isn't it? It's par with Disney almost, isn't it?
Yeah, for 7 million, it has to be there, doesn't it?
7 million?
Oh, what?
Yeah, apparently this advert cost £7 million to make.
Get away.
£7 million?
If they were paying that much for that kind of advert, right? It means they're making far too much money.
I need someone to rely on. And if you have a minute, why don't we go?
Who's that singing? That's what, I like that song. Who was it singing?
I think it was Lily Allen.
But for £7 million, you think that they'd have someone like Barbara Streisand, wouldn't you, singing it?
Is this to be the end of everything? So I
won't wait. What is it? What is it? Selfridges! Harrods! Selfridges!
John Lewis!